Welcome to our 24th lesson in the book of Daniel. I've entitled it Nebuchadnezzar, the Saved Man. And throughout this particular vision, we've seen how God actually views the sinner. If you're following along in the handouts, our very first slide after the title slide shows our character before salvation, assuming one has become saved. And for you to grasp or appreciate the extent of depravity that occurs for each and every one of us being conceived in sin, and even after salvation, we still struggle in sin, but we are not of sin anymore. But we still have the flesh that continually sins. If you want to see the frustration of that, Paul does an excellent job of describing his own frustration with his own sin in Romans chapter 7. The mid to latter part of that chapter, he just goes through and says, this is not what I want to do, but what I want to do, I fail at doing it constantly. And don't we all? Because the real issue is we are the ones doing it, and that's why we fail. The only way that we can be successful is in Christ. But we consistently, like errant little toddlers, go for the electric outlet. This just, maybe it won't shock me this time. Or whatever. And we just fall on our face. But that is what the Hagiazo process is all about, in refining us for eternity future. But before salvation, we think we're men, we think we're women, we think we're people, but we're not. We're animalistic. Adam turned down being a man when he sinned, as did woman turn down being human when she sinned. And what did they get in return? Violence, degradation, lies, and death. And we do the same thing. We can't blame the fact that we were born in sin. That's just a fact. The reason that we're accountable for our sin is that we embrace it. And we're going to touch on that again as we go through this, but I've covered in some detail in our past several lessons on Daniel chapter 4. But after salvation, we have God's nature. We are not just restored, that's the knee-jerk answer. We're actually elevated above where Adam and Eve were. They did not have God's nature in them. But at salvation, now with the new covenant since the day of Pentecost, we have God's nature. We are more than people. But we're not gods. We are adopted sons of God. But that doesn't make us gods. And there are some heretical teachings out there that make this claim. That is not true. We never enter the realm of being God. That is, of course, the lie of Satan from the beginning, and it continues. But we change from being unreasonable, animalistic, violent, to being reasonable. Now we're dragging the dead flesh along with us, so it's a slow transition. When we leave this body behind, then we will have a much better appreciation of what Christ purchased for us worth his death. Now, as I talked about in previous lessons, is that Nebuchadnezzar is undergoing an experience somewhat like Job. See, he was saved by adversity or through adversity. In fact, I made quite a case in our last lesson, and because it was similar to Job, and we know that Job was struck by Satan, who was allowed to, within the limitations that God set. Satan did it to accuse Job, to show that Job was a failure. Well, don't need Satan for that, because we're all failures. That's sin. So I don't need Satan to show me I'm a failure. In fact, most of the time we don't need Satan to show us that, because we have enough people standing around telling us that in one form or another. But God meant it for Job's salvation. And Job became saved. And I believe that is the pattern for many of us. As we struggle, it is because God has allowed Satan to accuse us, to fail, to pressure us so that we will fail. But in that failure, we recognize, only because God allows us to, why we failed. And it was because of us. Not because of Satan, but because of us. Each of us. Born in sin, conceived in sin, carry the seeds of our own failure. And there's no amount of uptalk that can prevent that or can change it. And we've talked about that in past lessons also. And so what I've done on this slide is I've compared Job's experience with Nebuchadnezzar's experience. Job was a wealthy potentate. He was a governor, a ruler, tribal leader, or something of that nature. We know he was a patriarch, like Abraham. In fact, it's debated when he lived. Of course, if you're lost, you debate if he lived at all, whether it was before, during, or after Abraham. And I've read articles on all three positions. But we do know that he was way back in that patriarchal time period, of which Abraham was a part of that in the early stages of, well, it took place throughout the book of Genesis. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, well, he was literally a potentate over a great civilization. He was king. Job, he was religious. He was priest over his family. That was the role of the patriarch in those days. There were priests, because Melchizedek was a priest. patterned after Shem, but they were replaced by the Aaronic priesthood under the law. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, like all leaders of societies at this time period, was both king and priest. He was the representative, the interface between his society and their gods and goddesses. And the priesthood was there to assist him. In fact, if you go through our study on Pharaoh, on Exodus, you'll see that Pharaoh was actually his priestly title, and King of Egypt was his governmental title, and the trials were in three sets of three. There were nine. One was showing his impotence as king, his impotence as priest, and the societal responsibility for their embracing their idolatry, their false religions. And as I've mentioned many times, you cannot separate government and religion. You can write it that way, but the American Constitution was not written that way. The Communist Constitution, and that's the one that's most often quoted today, is written that way, or was, the USSR. The American Constitution simply states that the federal government will make no laws respecting or favoring a religion. In other words, it's not going to be a state-run religion. But the religion is where you get your sense of right and wrong from. Even an atheist has religion. That informs your values. Now, you can deny that all day long. That's fine. But we are made in God's image, though corrupted by sin. And in Romans 1, 18 through 28, actually down in the end of the chapter, we see that it is the internal witness God's reality that each person is born with. That's why it's always wrong to steal, kill, so on, throughout history, no matter your culture. Job was reduced to poverty and lived as an animal on trash. Now, he retained his mind, but he had these probably leprous, oozing sores. So he was an outcast. And nobody else wanted the leprosy. He was living on a trash heap, using shards of pottery to scrape the pus out of his oozing sores. And I'm sure it was pretty terrible. Anybody's ever been around infection, you know, it smells. You can't hide that. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was literally reduced to an animalistic mind and forced into nature. He thought he was top dog. He thought, I am king over all of this. In fact, they actually said that. You go back up to earlier in chapter 4, you'll see where Daniel interpreted the dream, and Nebuchadnezzar had an entire year to meditate over the reality of the interpretation that Daniel told him. And yet, in verse 29 of chapter 4, it says, the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power, as a royal residence and for the glory of me? Because remember, sinners, it's always about me. Never about you. It's always about me. And in your mind, it's always about me. You just substitute yourself in there. Now, Job's ordeal lasted an extended period of time. Things moved a lot slower in those days. And when we say an extended period of time, we don't know how long that was. Long enough for his three friends to hear about his news, his misfortunes, his fall from wealth and power and position into abject poverty, to network together and decide to go see him. Because they're going to fix him, and not by charity. They're going to fix him by having him admit his sin. Of course, they couldn't get him to admit his sin. But Job was making some outlandish claims of his own, too. Nebuchadnezzar's ordeal lasted 7 years. Now, the modern mindset just says, would say he had a bout of insanity and it would happen at all, and it just cleared up spontaneously at the end of 7 years. And he, because he was sane again, got restored to power. That's because people are ignorant about how politics worked in those days. When you're deposed from power, you're usually deposed permanently. So you can't come back and cause trouble for the people that took power. And Nebuchadnezzar did not suffer a bout of insanity. He was reduced to this. And as I showed in previous lessons, I believe it's because God allowed demonic possession. In other words, God says, this is what's actually going on, and I'm going to show you, I'm going to fill your cup up to overflowing with what you want. You say, I thought what I wanted. Oh, yeah, it was. You didn't think it was. So you're only looking, and we do this with sin. We only look at the parts that we want to look at. I want to be rich. I want to be powerful. I want the beautiful women, the handsome men. I want. And we don't see, or we ignore what comes with that. Well, God shows us, as he showed through Nebuchadnezzar, what goes with that. What is the price? The price is being an animal. An animalistic in your mind. Because you're not human. You masquerade as human, but sin has degraded us. And seven, of course, is the number of fullness, completion. So Nebuchadnezzar got his cup overflowing. And remember, in Romans 1, 18 through 32, it says at least three times that God gave them up. God doesn't go around beating sinners up because he's sinners. He just lets them have the consequences of their actions, and he lets them go and do their thing until it's time for judgment. And if you die in your sin, you face absolute reality immediately. But that's not the judgment. The judgment is later. Remember, God talked to Job and said, "Clothe yourself as a man. Stand up. Answer me." Because Job was now saved. God restored Nebuchadnezzar. He gave Nebuchadnezzar back his reasoning. And the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar did, he humbled himself. When it says in the ESV that he blessed God, it carries a connotation that he humbled himself to God. He started off in immense pride. And he ends up being a man and humbling himself before God. See, in pride, you're animalistic because it's just you. Job gave a humbled confession. Nebuchadnezzar gave, three times in chapter 4, a humbled confession. God doubled Job's position, his wealth, everything except wives. He had the same wives. But he had more children, same number of children. So they're actually doubled because when people die, they don't go out of existence. They just leave this physical creation. And God magnified Nebuchadnezzar's majesty, so that what Nebuchadnezzar thought he had before, it was very prideful of, he now has it in abundance, but not because of his works, but because of God's graciousness, and he recognizes that. So what's the difference in Nebuchadnezzar's natures? Because that is instructive for all of us. We're all born with a sin nature, Romans 3:23. All have sinned. All. Let's just go there. Romans 3:23. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All of us have. Well, that's what sin does. It takes pride. Because the pride of life, that is one of the characteristics of covetousness of sin. It's we take responsibility for others' accomplishments. Nebuchadnezzar did not build the Babylonian culture, really the Mesopotamian culture. He was a recipient of it. He added a few touches in Babylon. But it was the, like Paris of the 19th century in Western culture, the seat of culture. The seat of all that was considered good. If you ignore the French Revolution where they tried to kill everybody. But still, French was the diplomatic language. The lingua franca of the day. Well, in Babylon, it was the culture that everybody else looked to. Even Assyria. So in his sin nature, you're prideful. Pride of life. His new heart, 1 Samuel 10:9, is not a new covenant. Because Christ hadn't come, Christ hadn't died. And the Holy Spirit had not come to indwell believers till the day of Pentecost. But what we do know about Old Testament salvation, it's always by faith, it's always by grace, because it's always the same throughout the scriptures. It's not a different salvation. It's an incomplete salvation because Christ hadn't died. But Christ's blood will cover backwards to that. You go to the third chapter of Romans, the latter part of the chapter, and it talks about that. But he had a new heart. And thus, when his reasoned return, God put him back, cast out the demons, and he was back in his right mind, he was humbled, looking upward to God rather than downward to self. Which was significant change. The sin nature attributes accomplishments of God to gods. Of course, once again, we go to Romans 18 through 28. Very instructive passage. People should memorize that, meditate on it. But now, with his new nature, his new heart, I should say, he attributes accomplishments to God. And not just accomplishments that he can see, but everything in earth, in heaven and on earth. Everything is under God's control. There is nothing that occurs without God. And I don't mean God knowing about it. I literally mean without God. He is the foundation for everything. With the sin nature, what was known of God was perverted, twisted. And was given characteristics of self and of animals' nature. Because that's all we know about. The only thing we know about God is in the Bible. This is not something that you just divine on your own. Because the lost mind can't do that. It can't. It has no knowledge of that. And we have no senses that will give us knowledge of that. We are literally captive to whatever our spiritual source tells us. Whether that's the demonic forces of Satan, because they be lying a lot, or the truth sources of God. And for us today, that would be the scriptures. Fundamentally, if you say the witness of the indwelling spirit. Well, this perversion of self then is what Paul talks about as ungodliness. It's the Greek word asabeia. And what it actually means is you literally refuse to attribute anything to God. That's truth. Now, you can make God into whatever form and fashion you want to. And there's many religions that masquerade as true Christianity that are not. And use the Bible and redefine God as this, that, and whatever. That's not how it works. That's the asabeia. And you can't undo your nature. That's the problem. See, what was known, what he knew about God was shown to him by God. Because only God can do that. Only God can remove that asabeia nature and replace it with the usabeia nature, a godly nature. But it's not obtained by logic. You can't argue somebody into it. You can't debate somebody into salvation. Let's try. Because they didn't know better. Nor do people get saved because miracles. The miraculous does not save people. because it doesn't change their heart. Change their heart is a miracle that God alone performs. And so the sin nature rejected God's mercy and grace remaining in sin. Remember, God, Christ in Matthew, in Sermon on the Mount, says the Father sends the Son and the rain on the just and the unjust. He's long-suffering, and we should be likewise if we are in his nature. But what this does is, this removes excuse, saying, God never gave me nothing good. Well, yeah, life, oxygen, sunshine, food, family, whatever you count as your benefits, those are all allowed by God. But you can attribute them to yourself or to other spiritual forces, but primarily yourself. But this Usabeya nature recognized one's position before God. It's itty bitty tiny speck. You're very humbled by the majesty and grace of God, and that he would recognize you and save you. Now, we know that the elephant in the room here is that God went to Nebuchadnezzar. What about the Jews? I mean, they're in their predicament in Babylonia, because of their idolatry. Why is God not interacting with them? Well, let's look. The Jews were called out of idolatry, Joshua 24, 1 through 5. Abraham's family was steeped in idolatry in Ur, which is southeast near the coast on the rivers. And God called Abraham out of that. But the Jews continually embraced idolatry over the law, even during the reception of the law. In Exodus 32, 1 through 6, the golden calf affair. And the Jews, during the period of the judges and afterwards, perverted law to idolatry. And even Moses' grandson participated in that idolatrous perversion of the law. And when the kingdom split, the northern kingdom embraced idolatry, reinstated the calf worship, had its own priesthood, its own sacrifices, its own everything. In fact, that was the ministry of Elijah and Elisha, was to witness to them that they are doing evil and to repent. And they never did, because they were outlawing the law. But the southern kingdom, they did worse, because they saw what happened to the northern kingdom when they were defeated and just erased off the map politically. And they did not turn from their idolatry. Now, there were kings that did institute reforms, but they didn't stick. And even they fell short. And so Judah, the southern kingdom, did much worse in God's eyes and was sent into captivity. Now, what were they doing in captivity? Well, they were developing the Kabbalah and the Talmudic customs and traditions. They weren't repenting at all. In fact, when they come back out of captivity, those that left Persia, those that went back to Judah, Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple and the city and so forth. By the time of Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, God just says, I'm disgusted with you. It'd just be better if you didn't do anything at all. Chapter 2, 1 through 12. Just be better if you just don't do this. Because doing it the way you're doing it, you don't care, you're apathetic, you don't believe in it, you might as well just be pooping on the altar, literally. God just says, I'm disgusted with you. And it's 400 years before he spoke to him again. So why did God deal with Nebuchadnezzar? Well, let's look at the truth. Nimrod unified the priest-king position. The Babel thing. Genesis 11, 1 through 9. And even after Babel, that idolatry spread as people spread, and it morphed and was changed to fit the changing cultural identities that were being developed as these groups divided into smaller and smaller subgroups. And some became more powerful, some didn't. And we see that what was known of God was replaced by man and nature. And there we go again, Romans 1, 18 through 28. Because that which may be known of God, the outward witness of God is, look up at the night sky, it's the universe. The inward testimony or witness of God is guilt. It is your innate basic sense of right and wrong. Now we reject that, and the whole point of developing a worldview is to reform that so that the evil of your culture is now considered good and God is considered evil. In a nutshell, that's basically what a worldview does. That's that Asabeya character again. That ungodly nature. Babylonians' idolatry was the height of Mesopotamian culture. Literally. Nebuchadnezzar's salvation may have broken the hold of Marduk or his worship on the Babylonian culture. That's not really the important part of the lesson, this lesson, but we're definitely going to be covering it in chapter 5 because it's going to become very important. But once again, I have to give you this historical framework, which is how I teach. Remember, we spent, when we came to the book of Daniel, we spent 3 weeks or so just looking at the world as Daniel would have known it, and tried to anyway. But even after Nebuchadnezzar was saved, others after him were not. They took away the wrong lesson. So Nebuchadnezzar opens up with a psalm. And it's a psalm that's consistent with other psalms in the Bible. That's how we know it's a truly changed heart. See, he doesn't launch into a logical apologetic of why he has changed. In fact, starting in verse 34, it says, I, Nebuchadnezzar lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned, and I blessed, humbled myself, acknowledging the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. Now, that's exactly how chapter 4 began, in verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar says to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. Might as well be the angels singing in Luke chapter 2 to the shepherds. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs. How mighty his wonders. See, it's a song. He's breaking into music here. Well, he's doing it again down here in verse 34, 35. And he's going to conclude in verse 37 the same thing. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he was able to humble. Because he did it to me. He ain't not fun, tell me. Now, why do we share our faith? Because a lot of people don't share their faith. But why do we share our faith? Or should be. So people will not have to go through what we went through to get saved. You want them to avoid those problems. You want them to avoid those troubles. You want them to take the freeway to salvation. Even though Christ himself tells us that the freeway doesn't go to salvation. It goes to Hellsville. And from there on, its final destination is a little warmer. That's the broad way. That's the wide way. There is no shortcut there. I spent my life trying to raise kids not to suffer what I suffered. And guess what? I failed every single one of them. If anything, I made it worse. It would have been better for them to have come to face with the horribleness of sin. And God saved them out of it. Remember, salvation is a birthing process. There is no shortcut there. None at all. So he breaks out into these hymns that the saved nature would understand. And it demonstrates a true change. It's like Psalm 11. If we go back and look at that a moment. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Nothing. Because there's nothing you can do. Period. Ever. It's your wanting to do it that is the problem. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. That's generic for all people. The Lord tests the righteous, but a soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Now, who's the righteous? Those who got saved? Now, Ephesians 1, 3 through 10. those whom he determined in eternity past before ever making this creation, whom he determined, he would pull off the pathway of hell and open their minds. That is the righteous. Who are the wicked? All of us. All have sinned. Why did God save me? Can't tell you. Because God won't tell me. Romans 9, 19 through 23. He says, I did it because they did it. And I'm not telling you why, because you wouldn't understand it. See, God's dominion, stone cut without hands, vision, remember that first vision, is everlasting. Both before this creation and after this creation. Nebuchadnezzar realized his kingship as a puff of air. It was here before he got here. It was here when he was absent for 7 years, acting like a cow out in the pasture, chewing cud with a blank look on his face, howling at the moon. If he's like the demonic of Gesodia, he couldn't even be bound with chains and ropes. He'd break them. They just had to leave him alone. And it'd be here long after he left. See, God is infinite. All persons who ever lived and will ever live are nothing because he is complete in himself. We can't all just add up together and say, okay, now, collectively, we are equal with you. Because God made us. That fact alone means we're never equal. You're never equal to those who formed you. You're never equal to your parents. You might surpass them in some things, other things not. But you're never equal to them. You came from them. And God, I know it's going to be a shock to some of you, God has limitations. He has to be consistent with his nature. And because God is infinite, there is not enough power to make another infinite being. See, the Son and the Spirit with him are the Trinity. With him are the Godhead. All are co-equal in attributes. See, God is the potter. And he spoke in Isaiah, and he spoke in Jeremiah, and he used the same illustration in Romans 9. That clay pot going to stand up, demand why you did that, why you made that like you did? No. When you go into the supermarket to buy meat or to buy milk or to buy fruit or veggies, you look, and your criteria determines what you choose. And what you leave behind may end up in the garbage heap. But you choose according to your criteria. And you're certainly not telling the fruits and veggies why you chose it. You are exercising the same prerogative of will that God is talking about in his illustration or metaphor of the potter. See, God has authority over heaven, the angels, and earth, people, and everything else that he created. These are the two sentient beings. Because he is their maker, and he did it according to His will. There is none who can hold God accountable, for no one is above God. There is no higher authority to appeal to. Unless you're into Luciferianism and Gnosticism, then the God of this creation, the God of the Bible, is literally just a demigod. And there's God above him, and you can appeal to him because he's always a good guy. Except that's made up nonsense. It doesn't even pass the smell test. You look at it just through logic alone and it falls apart because it never explains the first cause. But this is the mind of the sinner. The mind of Job, who could not answer God and yet demanded and stated that he was going to put his charges against God on his shoulder, march into heaven, and demand of God why bad stuff happened to him. Because he didn't sin, just so you know. Well, Elihu had to just stand up and tell Job to his face that he's just a wicked man. How dare he talk like that to God? And rightly so. He is the only character in the book of Job who's not condemned. Now, Job was chastened. He was told, get dressed, get healed, get dressed, stand up. I'll treat you like a man here because I just saved you. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to tell me what you know. And if you come up with the right answers, I'll just sit here and listen to you because you're like me. And Job just had to sit there in absolute dumbfounded silence because he had no answers. And the whole quest of natural philosophy ostensibly is to understand how creation works. But literally, is to understand how it works so that we can take control and be gods. But we can't even understand the very nature of energies. Hebrews 11:3. And these are the invisible supports of that which is visible. And we can't even define them. We know they're facts, ish, kinda, a little bit. And control some of them, kinda, ish, a little bit. But they're like tools. They can help you or they can hurt you. So Nebuchadnezzar's kingship is restored. His majesty is increased with his humility. See, what he tried to do lost was grab it with pride. Because that's what we do as sinners. We try to make ourselves great. And we can't make ourselves great. We belittle everyone around us so that we seem greater. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar started off in chapter 2, tell me my dream or I'm going to kill everybody. Whoa, get back, guy. In chapter 3, it was, you three aren't worshiping like I told you to? I'm going to kill you. Ooh, they survived. Dude, that's not good. Oh, and everyone around now is, oops, not liking me. Because I already threatened to kill them. Now it shows I'm impotent. And of course, you have to go back to the lessons to understand that. So it's the third time in this chapter that he extols the Lord, showing he has completely embraced Daniel's God as very God. It's an old term. It means the God, the only God. All the other gods are not gods at all. You're just worshiping Satan. Deuteronomy 32 tells us that, as does 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I believe. So with the removal of his demonic possession, I believe, though the chapter never says that, Nebuchadnezzar's faithful advisors returned to him. Now, this would, of course, include Daniel and his three companions. He is restored to the throne as ruler, as God promised, and with greater influence as a wise king, because he increased in wisdom. If you go to Proverbs, like 14:28 or 20:28 or 25, 2 through 6, or even 31, 3 through 5, it says that the saved, once they have the mind of God, the changed heart, their majesty, their wisdom increases. Did for Solomon. He just got confused. He allowed his flesh to take over again. And there'd be many a Christian who falls in that same boat. But Nebuchadnezzar here bows before God's glory, knowing only the Lord can humble the proud flesh. In this life, that's what we call salvation, or at the judgment, when your own prideful works and words condemn you. Revelations 27 through 15. Nebuchadnezzar may have kept the outward societal trappings to prevent the disintegration of his culture. And we have precedents for that. If you go back to 2 Kings 5, 15 through 19, Nahum, the Syrian, not a Syrian, the Syrian general, got leprosy. There were various grades of leprosy in those days. And he came to Elijah to get healed. Elijah says, "What are you going to talk to him?" Says, "Go down to the river and dip yourself in that seven times. You'll be fine." And Nahum walked away. He ran away angry. He said, "I got cleaner rivers in Syria. I'm not dipping here." He had to be persuaded and said, "Yeah, but you had leprosy in Syria. You had no hope. Yeah, is it really going to hurt you to try this?" So he goes and dips, and of course, on the seventh time, he comes up, he's scared. He goes back to Elijah. He's humbled. He's profusely thanking him. He wants to give him all these gifts he brought. Elijah takes nothing. But Nahum makes a request. He says, "When I go into the house of my gods," not my gods, "but when I go into the house of the gods with the king, part of my official duties, is this forgiven?" And Elijah says, "Yeah, because you are not worshiping. There are some things you may have to do. Now, you're not violating a moral law. You're not robbing the banks. You're not stealing. You're not coveting. You're not lying. You're not doing any of that. But what you are doing is participating in official duties. That is required of your authoritative position." And so I imagine Nebuchadnezzar was probably doing the same thing with the annual thing of Marduk. But probably not taking off all his vestiges and worshiping and allowing himself to be slapped, which was part of the annual New Year's celebration. And this probably weakened the future king's adherence to Marduk worship and ceremonies. In fact, Cyrus attributed Babylon's defeat to their irreverence of Marduk. Nabonidus didn't even worship Marduk. He worshiped the sin god. And I would encourage you to go read about that. It's not really part of the lesson here to go into that detail. But we're going to go into some aspects of this in chapter 5. Now, everything that happened with Nebuchadnezzar presages the first fruits dispensation, which is basically Gentile salvation or the church age. See, God performed this dramatic salvation as a metaphor presaging what was to come. He went to the Gentiles, not the Jews. See, in Jewish Talmudic writings, Nebuchadnezzar is vilified for destroying the temple, even though God miraculously and openly saved him while they developed their customs, their traditions that Christ condemned. The Persian Jews relied on their own trickery and sexual manipulation rather than on prayer and faith in God. And then they turned around and celebrated their works by creating a false feast, Purim. That's the whole book of Esther. Not once is God mentioned. Not once is there a prayer. Not once is there anything other than works in that whole book. And that's the Jews that stayed in Persia. How about the Jews that returned? Well, they codified their new traditions, and the Talmud, the Midrash, the Mishnah, and also developed mysticism, the Kabbalah, and remained prideful, so much so that God says you might as well be offering poop on the altar. Guys, It's just nasty what you're doing. And then when Christ came, they killed him. See, they were to go into captivity to be filled with idolatry and get sick of it. That's why God gives you over. You either immerse in it and drown, or you immerse in it and just get disgustingly tired of it and turn to God. Well, that's because God is opening up your mind. Also, Christ gave Jews the sign of Jonah. Not simply because Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, just like Christ was going to be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights before he rose from the dead. But also because Jonah was sent to save Gentiles. If you read the book of Jonah, you know what you find out? Jonah hated Gentiles. Jonah didn't want to do that. Jonah just wanted to watch them all die. And he got ticked off because they didn't die. They repented. The Assyrians. So this was before the captivity here. A couple hundred years. And Jonah's angry. And God says, why are you ticked off? Because I knew you'd save them. It's disgusting. Well, I used them to erase the northern kingdom because of their idolatry that they would not repent of. Just like he used the Babylonian captivity as punishment for their idolatry, Judas. But because of his promise to David and the need to preserve the Davidic lineage for Christ, he sends them back. But Jonah is the Jew. He's the picture of the Jews. And he hates Gentiles. He just wants to see them all dead or enslaved. And that attitude still has not changed today. Even Christ, in his prodigal son parable, for focusing on the younger son, the sinful man who ran off in Gentile land and just wallowed in the mud. And literally, that's where he ended up, because that's how he was living when he had money, like a pig wallowing in sin. Animalistic. Unclean. He came to his senses. In other words, salvation. God opened his eyes. He says, how did you get here? He's disgusted. He goes back to his dad and says, I sinned. His father, rich, powerful, runs to meet him, humbled himself, humiliated himself to run to meet this son who was lost but has now returned. The older son, he just ticked. Well, the older son represents the Jews. Works-based. We've been doing all this, and we got nothing. I want some good times. He hated God. He hated his father, who's a metaphor for God. And he really didn't like the younger son either. But the younger son had no inheritance. He's not going to take anything away from the older. He already took his inheritance and squandered it. The Gentiles, all mankind, did that. God called out the Jews to be his people. To take his message out into the world, preparing all the world for salvation. They just didn't do that. Too good. See, the issue here is that God does not need anybody to defend his righteousness, his holiness. And yet that's where works-based religions camp out at. We're going to force everyone to honor God. We're going to force everyone to honor our God. You're either going to get evangelized by the sword or you're going to die. You either all get baptized, Catholics or whatever, or Islam or whatever you are, or you all die. Well, that's not good. That's not evangelism. It's not salvation. And God has an entire retinue in heaven. Go to Revelation chapter 4. He doesn't need anybody to remind him he's holy. He exudes holiness. All creation is honoring him. God doesn't need anybody to defend his holiness. If he did that, he's got angels, and they just cut you where you stand. Because that's kind of what they know. Instead, as Christ said, there is more rejoicing in heaven over the salvation of sinners as it reflects the humility and death of the Son in bringing life out of death. That's spiritual life, because we're spiritually dead. But false religions, which is all religions but the true biblical gospel faith, is of Satan. And what he's doing is he's bringing death out of life. Now we're talking about physical death here, separation of the body. Because that's what he does. See, the lost, both Jews and Gentiles, seek to enslave the world, the masses, to themselves, the elites, because this is the goal of their father, Satan, who's enslaving all mankind to himself. Now, we all think in our own little minds we are the elite. We are the chosen few. Because it's always about, can we say it together? Me. Do we ever think that we're not some of the elite? Yes, most of us aren't. But it doesn't matter. Because even the elites have bodies of flesh, get old, die, and then meet God. And discover they're not elite at all. See, Christ came not just for Jews who were hardened in their sinful pride. He also came for Gentiles who had no hope or expectation of salvation. Isaiah said in chapter 9, they who are in darkness have seen a great light. And Christ said that referred to him. In fact, John the Baptist's father in Luke 1, 67 through 79, says the role of John the Baptist is to announce the coming Messiah who is the light to the Gentiles and the Jews. And if you go to the opening hymn of John chapter 1, Christ is light. And all in sin is darkness. See, the prideful do not seek salvation. They don't want salvation. When I was lost, I didn't want salvation. I wanted relief from my sin, because I wanted to be rich, and I wanted to be powerful, and I wanted to be sexy, and I wanted to you know, the usual smorgasbord of stuff, but not salvation. Oh, I taught scripture-ish. Wrong. Wasn't saved. I wasn't teaching the true gospel. But God saves those who hate him, who are his enemies. Just as he came to Nebuchadnezzar, Paul, you and myself, and all others who are saved. Man does not go seeking God. God seeks man. He came to Abraham. Wives of Sarah, of Abram and Sarai, are metaphors of God's salvation of life for those who walk in death except for God's grace. Romans 5, 6 through 11. Abram walked in idolatry. We talked about that already in this lesson. But he had no hope of life until God came and called him to himself. Even though if you read the Talmudic imaginations, they picture something much different happening. But that's because they rejected the scriptures, their own scriptures. And would rather follow their own musings into death. And Abram, well, he was saved by faith before receiving the sign of circumcision. And that is what separates the Jews from the Gentiles. Remember, they were to be his witnesses in the world, not be of the world. And Sarai's womb was dead, barren, incapable of life, until God quickened it so life came from death. In the form of Isaac. His works-based efforts of both Sarai and Abram with the Egyptian slave maid produced Ishmael. And Ishmael tormented Isaac to such an extent that Abraham was forced to send them away. Well, that's what God did to the Jews. He sent them away into the wilderness. But after the dispensation of first fruits, the true Jews will be called out of death into life, spreading the gospel during the great tribulation. This is Ezekiel's valley of dried bones. Ezekiel 37, 1 through 14, Zechariah 12 through 10. 12:10. And Revelation 7, 1 through 8, the 144,000, are those being called out to take the gospel and die. A lot. Remember how Nebuchadnezzar's dream started? He was the tree. Daniel told him he was the tree covering the whole earth. And the last lesson we saw, that's a metaphor. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's tree was exchanged for a true tree of life. See, his vision with himself as the tree nourishing the animals, because that's what Mesopotamian culture does. It's sinful culture. And it propagates sin. And thus it feeds sinners who are animalistic in nature. And this idolatry spread throughout the earth and throughout time from Nimrod by Mesopotamian culture. And it's extant today as Luciferianism, with branches of Gnosticism, posthumanism, pantheism, and Christendom, all those beliefs that claim to be God but reject the gospel, the true gospel of the scriptures. See, God snipped this tree because it is not a tree of life. It is a tree of death, fit only for those who remain entrenched in their sin. See, the tree of life embraces the Bible. It encompasses the Bible, the gospel, because the gospel is the whole Bible. Once man sinned, they no longer ate from the tree of life. In fact, they were tossed out of the garden, lest they remain trapped in their sinful flesh and cannot be saved. See, God did that as a blessing. See, unable to leave this body, which is only designed for this creation. It's perishable. It was never designed to last forever. It can't last forever. So much so that modern man wants to add nanotechnology mechanics to it to make it last forever. Because it breaks down. Even the mind, we say the mind, we mean the brain, which is not the mind. It is simply... it is simply the switchboard between the soul and the body. But all saved will have access to the tree of life for eternity in the New Jerusalem. Revelations 22, 1 through 5. So each of us is a sapling. We begin life as a sapling of death. We either produce no fruit or bad fruit. And we cannot do otherwise. Apple tree doesn't produce grapes. You can graft grapes into it. Don't know why you want to, but you could. You can take non-fruit trees and graft branches of fruit trees into them. In fact, I've got two lemon trees out there. That's exactly how it's done. But like Nebuchadnezzar, each of us is a tree of death spreading bad fruit. In fact, Christ cursed the fig tree that had no figs as an example of what he does and will do with everyone who remains in their sin. You got no fruit. Or worse yet, you got bad fruit. See, trees of their own nature can't become good trees unless changed by Christ. That's salvation. That's the new nature. Each person sins after salvation. The difference? Our new nature conscience convicts us of sin and we repent. Those still lost resist their conscience until it is seared without guilt. You want to get rid of guilt? Throw away your pills because they don't help. Throw away the drugs and of all kinds and stripes. They don't help. Just keep doing it. And telling yourself it's good. And your conscience will become seared. And you'll no longer have guilt in that area. Of course, we call those kinds of people psychopaths. Or if we're kind, we'll call them sociopaths. They're very dangerous people because now they have no guilt, no governor, nothing to stop them from doing whatever they think they want to do. See, every single person is a missionary. Every single one. Either of death or of life. Everybody is a missionary. Nebuchadnezzar was a missionary of death, but he was changed to a missionary of life. That was his message. That is the same for everybody who's saved. Even just by walking down the street breathing, you are a missionary. People look at you. When you talk, you reflect your nature. Now, the Christian, we're kind of confused because we have the internal new nature of Christ, but we still have the body of flesh. And the body of flesh never quits, never gives up, never surrenders. And hates the things of God. And is constantly at war against them. It is only through the Spirit of God that it is controlled. And then we take control. We grab the helm away from the Holy Spirit and say, I can do it now. And next thing you know, it's like putting a 3-year-old in charge of driving the car. You got to go down the interstate at 70 miles an hour in a straight line. It's great. And you tell the 3-year-old to take the wheel. How long do you think that's going to last you? Well, that's exactly how long it takes us to mess up our lives. Because the moment we wrest control away from the Spirit, guess what? We don't have control. And in a car, Newton takes control. And he's a terrible driver. Well, so are we. Very bad drivers. When we take control. Then we have to repent. And give control back to God. But each of us is a missionary. So my question to you. Are you like Nebuchadnezzar? Are you a missionary of life? I can't answer that question for you. You can go to 1 John, where John gives guidance on how you can judge yourself, but the lost will never see themselves there. It's only by the grace of God that you can see yourself as God sees you. A tiny child that needs absolute guidance from Christ. And we just need to stop pretending that we're adolescents wrestling control all the time. And humble ourselves like the little children that we are and come to Christ, who will not send us away. Thank you.